Yeah.
Dave.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave.
What?
It's time to start the show.
That's right. It's 4 o'clock, and you're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. We just listened to a little bit of Seal, Crazy, and mahalo to Dane for a great melodic flow show.
As always.
Okay, let's see. It's 4 o'clock time now for Out of the Box. I'm your host, Dave Giroux, with co-host Jonathan Jay here.
Hey, aloha, Dave. It's good to see you.
The opinions expressed during this program did not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its board, underwriters, volunteers, or members.
And mahalo to all those folks for supporting Kauai Community Radio.
Yeah, seriously, without you, we couldn't do it. So thank you.
Okay, well, we have a great show lined up for you today. We have a special guest in the studio here, Nassim Haramain.
Hey.
And he is, I don't know, I ran a promo earlier in the day.
He can run it now, Dave, if you like.
Called you a controversial physicist, cosmologist, ancient alien theorist, and new age guru.
Oh, really?
How does that fit?
I don't know about the new age guru thing.
That was the one I had a question about. I wasn't so sure about that one.
But you are, in a sense. You know, a lot of people look to you for information and for guidance.
That's true. But I don't have any disciples running around taking care of me.
Right, yeah. Well, you do touch on a lot of different topics, and we're going to hope to touch on a few of them today. And also, I think what we're going to do is talk with you for about the first half hour, and then we're going to open up the phone lines and take some calls.
Sounds good.
So you wanted to ask a couple questions then about background?
The very first thing I wanted to do is get the pronunciation of your name correct, because I've heard it a couple different ways, and I'm a big believer in getting people's names right.
Uh-huh.
So how do you, and we were talking about this before you came in the studio, and it dawned on us, well, let's just ask Nassim.
All right, yes.
So please, slowly and for the record, please pronounce your name for us so we can get it right.
It's Nassim.
Nassim?
Yeah, Haramain.
Haramain.
Yeah.
Nassim Haramain.
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of a name is that?
Well, it's Persian, and it means literally little breeze in the temple.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I like that. Maybe something that ruffles the scroll work a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
My mom thought of me more as a hurricane. Yes. And actually, my last name, Haramain, in Egyptian means a double pyramid, which is interesting because I do a lot of geometry.
Hmm. Oh, like perhaps an inverted pyramid.
Yeah, like an octahedron.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Huh, okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit of your early life story. How did you come into the world? Where was that? How did your parents meet each other? And then, of course, at some point, you wind up here on Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, I was born in Switzerland, in Geneva. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that my mom, during the Second World War, was swift away and hidden in a train. Away from Mussolini's regime.
Oh.
And
was your family Jewish or?
No, Italian.
Oh, okay.
But it was difficult for the Italian population as well.
Sure.
And my grandma needed to escape Mussolini's regime, and so they moved to Switzerland.
A nice neutral country.
Yeah, they hit the kids under the bench of a train and move to Switzerland. And so my mom grew up in Geneva, in French Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And my father came there as a student in child psychology.
From Persia?
From Iran,
from
yeah.
Okay.
He was an assistant professor at the University of Tehran, and he wanted to finish his PhD under the directorship of Piaget, which is famous for child psychology. And so he came to Geneva and was learning French and, finishing his PhD. And my mom was a dancer. She danced in troupes. you know, classical ballet and some folkloric dance.
I can tell this is a nice story.
And she, her troupe went through Iran on a tour. And she really loved Iran, and she really enjoyed being there. And when she came back, she wanted to learn Iranian. So she knew there was students from Iran at the University of Geneva. So she went out there, and she put an ad up asking to learn Iranian, if there was a student available to teach Iranian to her. And my father answered the ad, and the rest is history.
Man honar man hastam.
I don't know any Iranian. I'm sorry.
as a snippet of Iranian, a friend taught me a while ago. It means I'm an artist.
Oh, wonderful. I never learned Iranian. I wish I had. I've never actually been to Iran because of all the difficulties of going there in times of war. But I would love to go one day.
So when you were a kid, you grew up speaking French in the house.
Exactly. Between my father and mother, French was the common language. And my grandmother spoke mostly Italian. So she would speak Italian a little bit to me, and I would answer in French. But I never actually learned Italian properly neither.
When did English come into your tongue, your mouth?
At the end of his PhD, my father got offered a job at the university, actually at the Piaget Institute, as the director of the Piaget Institute. And he considered it, but he didn't feel like it was appropriate for him to spend his career under the shadow of Piaget, which was pretty large. And so he wanted to kind of get out of that environment, and he got offered a job as the director of the child psychology section of the University of Montreal. So we ended up moving to Canada.
But still, that's Quebec.
Yes, that's Quebec. And that was French. So now I learned Quebecer, which actually is where I learned my English. So a lot of people think I'm Quebecer when they hear my English, because I learned my English with a Quebecer accent.
Okay. Well, you know, actually, your story fills in a lot of the pictures for me, because your accent is not easy to place.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then so I think I was about 12 or 13 when my father sent me to an Ontario summer camp that was only English. There was not one French person there. And so,
is it playing a trick on you?
Yeah. I learned English in a hurry. I spent like 2 months there, and when I came out, I knew English. And I moved to British Columbia, Alberta, and British Columbia when I was in the ski industry.
Mm-hmm. You were a ski instructor.
I was a ski instructor,
for how long?
Ski coach.
For 10 years?
For almost 15 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. And I moved up the ranks in the ski business in Canada for all that time. And eventually, but I always had this passion for physics, and I really, you know, did it as a hobby for all that time. But eventually, it took over my life. And
yeah. Now, you were living in a van up in BC for a while.
I was. When I finished my ski career, which is, you know, usually in the ski industry, the remunerations are not very high. And so,
plus the pay is lousy too.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, remuneration. And then, so I was really, you know, not doing so well financially, that I could all of a sudden just turn around and start studying physics at full time. So I had to reduce my expenses the best I could. And so to do so, I moved into a van, so I didn't have rent to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold most of my ski equipment. I kept my climbing equipment. And I just started to work day and night on studying physics. And I did that in the van almost for 5 years straight.
Wow.
Yes.
Even in the winter.
Oh. Although in the winter, most of the periods, I would go down south into, you know, the high deserts of California and Arizona. And I would park myself either Joshua Tree or Red Rocks or, you know, in various climbing areas and continue my studies and climb, you know, at sunrise and sunset. It was a wonderful life. It was very peaceful. I had no responsibility, no cell phone, no computers. I was doing everything by hand. And I would stop in universities when I would come out of the deserts or the mountains, because sometimes I would have to go back and maybe do a few months of teaching, skiing during the busy season, during Christmas holidays and so on, so I could keep going again. And I remember when I was coming back north, many nights, though, where it was so cold, I was... you know, in the later times, I did buy a little computer and I was hugging my computer in my bed
for warmth.
And, it was really an amazing time though of discoveries. And I would stop in universities in here and there as I went along and gathered materials for a few weeks and then be isolated again, studying and writing and exploring.
Interesting. Now, one thing. Now, you didn't get a PhD in physics.
I didn't.
I mean, a lot of people writing papers now in journals all have PhDs in physics. So why didn't you want to get one of those?
Well, for me, it wasn't a goal to get an education. For me, it was an exploration of the structure of the universe. I was not necessarily interested in, you know, obtaining some certification or even making a career of physics. I was just genuinely interested for self-discovery. I wanted to know how I got here and what is this place and how it works. Yeah. And so it wasn't really anything to do with the educational system as much as me wanting to discover and explore. And one thing led to another, and, you know, eventually I reached levels where I needed to study more seriously to be able to answer more deeper questions in the physics of the world. And many physicists that I, colleagues and so on that I work with think of me as somebody that has level of education of a PhD, but I currently don't hold a PhD.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you seem to kind of hold that in derision. Kind of you don't think very highly of a lot of people that do have PhDs, or maybe it's the curriculum that agree with.
Maybe Dave, you could phrase that as a question, and then Nassim could answer if that's true or not.
Right. Well, I mean, I've heard you talk about, you know, some people that do have PhDs and the curriculum that they teach, you don't necessarily agree with.
Well, it's not that I don't necessarily hold them highly. It's just that I find that the educational system does not encourage self-discovery and creativity and new ideas. Many of the systems that are in place right now, such as the peer review system and so on, are actually counterindicative in terms of helping people be creative and come up with new ideas and think outside the box. And right. So this is one of the reasons maybe that I've been able to come up with new ideas that are, you know, maybe more controversial, but that might have some value. And that is that I've not been educated in such a way that, like, concepts have been shoved into my head and I've had to accept them in order to pass exam and in order to pass certifications and so on. So I've been able to keep thinking outside the box all the way through my self-education, which in some ways I think has allowed me to go further than many people that have certifications.
Right.
So you're saying that maybe the rigors and the structure of education that you have been able to maintain a freedom from have allowed you to think creatively and to, I'm just trying to paraphrase what you're saying.
Yes. You know, it's just like this. When you're inside the institution and you're working there and you're teaching there and you get caught in some ways into a specific mode of thinking of things,
sure.
of exploring things,
sure.
and so on. And
expectations that you have to meet.
Exactly.
Structures that you have to work within.
That's right. All of a sudden, you can't just start teaching a whole new way of thinking of physics to your students. So you're teaching this every day. You're thinking that way every day.
It becomes a groove maybe that you get stuck in.
It becomes extremely difficult to think any other way. And anything that comes your way that is different from what you're teaching
has to be deflected.
It has to be wrong,
right?
You know, and so it closes minds and it closes the door to exploration and creativity. And I think it's been one of the largest difficulties of our society in terms of our capacity to evolve past. The oil-based industry that we live in and all the difficulties that we're facing now.
Well, it's definitely a paradigm, you know, a standard model that they preach in these schools. And, you know, if you don't spout back the line there, then you won't pass. You won't get your degree.
That's right.
And so even if you have some other thoughts, you've got to keep them to yourself for that time being, and maybe you can explore them later, but you're not allowed to be creative, you know.
That's right.
In a system like that.
And as I've seen throughout the 20-some years now that I've been interacting with the mainstream scientific community, it's the extremely rare example of a physicist or a scientist that's able to retain that explorative, creative mode while being able to, you know, conform to the thoughts that are necessary in order to pass higher levels of our certification. So it's very rare for an individual to actually come out of there after some 10 years of studies and with a PhD and still have that creative, you know, bright eye.
It's a rebellious kind of a thing, I think.
That's right.
Because you have to be pushing it out from inside. You say, no, I hear what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
I'm saying something different.
Exactly. And not only that, you have to be able to write on the exam something that you may not believe in. And not forget what you actually believe in.
Right. You become like a Cold War spy to yourself.
That's right. And in some ways, you know, the educational system, the way it's set up right now, is set up to create autobatons. And actually,
yeah, little robots.
Yeah.
You tell them something and you ask them to regurgitate it.
That's
to
right.
tell you back. And that's how they demonstrate their success.
That's right.
It's ironic though, because the rebels who have all the new ideas that don't conform to the old ideas are so often held up in our society. Like I'm thinking of the whole Apple ad campaign, Think Different.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Feynman is an example of one physicist who comes to my mind who had a rebellious attitude about stuff. He's like, no, energy is coming out of nothing. And people were like, well, how can that be possible? And he's like, well, here's a diagram.
Right. Exactly. Many examples are there throughout history of great discoveries, great inventors, great thinkers being the ones that were the odd out. You know, the other man out. And that was the guy that was thinking different, the guys that didn't fit in. You know, even people like Einstein, you know.
Didn't speak till he was 4 years old, and he was a clerk.
He was a clerk at the patent office, a third-class clerk.
Yeah, that's not front-end physicist territory.
He was the only one out of his class to not be able to get a job after he graduated. You know, in Switzerland at the time was unheard of. When he was younger, he was sent home with a note from his school director saying this child needs special education because he's just not bright and so on.
That's how he came up with special relativity.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So it
seems like he was a good example of someone who was taking information into his own head and rolling it around and not so much listening to what's going on. He had his own internal dialogue going on.
Exactly. And I think that as well, the people that are like that typically don't fit in so well, because they don't conform very well.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about your childhood. I've heard interviews with you before where you talk about the long bus ride home, mm-hmm. where you're basically taking the entire geometry lesson apart in your head, putting it back, turning it inside out, and putting it back together.
Right.
You seem to have been able to maintain your rebellious attitude. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what that was like for you as a kid, where that started.
I mean,
right.
That's not the way typical 10-year-olds operate that I know of anyway. So.
Right, right. Actually, you'd be surprised, I think. Well, you know, I think that a lot of young minds are, they have a fairly good sense of instinctively, maybe, of the foundation of creation. And then they're taught differently, maybe. I don't know. But in my case, I had a very, very difficult childhood in terms of trying to fit in. I was a lonely child. I didn't have friends or very little friends. Because of my name and my origins in Canada, at the time, most people didn't even know that Iran existed. Before the hostage situation, Iran was almost unknown. And there is, so, you know, I was often, bullied. It was really difficult. I didn't do good at school. I'm extremely dyslexic. I had a hard time reading. There was all sorts of issues that made it so that I was fairly lonely and isolated. And in another way, that permitted me to really kind of self-reflect and spend a lot of time thinking about things and thinking about the universe and how it works and how I fit in it and what is this thing I'm experiencing. You know, it actually promoted self-reflection and exploration of the natural world.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, well, let's jump into one of the topics. I mean, you have so many different areas in which you study and mm-hmm. and talk about. Why don't we start with ancient history? Now, you've done a lot of study of ancient history. Why did you do that? How does it fit into your study of physics? Mm-hmm. What were you looking for in the archaeological records?
Well, there's many reasons. One of them is that from young, I started to look at the natural world with maybe a little bit different set of eyes. I started to think there must be some fundamental pattern at the base of creation that makes all this possible. You know, I was a ski instructor. I was a climber. I would look at the crystals of snowflakes.
These little tiny hexagons.
That's right. And, like, not one of them was exactly the same.
And yet they all had the same base pattern.
Exactly. They were all hexagons. Mm-hmm. Like, how was that possible? Why was that true? And
fluke. Could be a fluke.
Yeah. I mean, the probability of that being a fluke was almost nil. So, you know, I was looking at the crystals in the rocks when I was climbing. I was looking at the plants, the flowers, and so on. And I felt like there must be this fundamental pattern. And quickly I realized that many ancient civilizations had similar concepts, meaning that they had in their esoteric knowledge and in their rituals and so on, commonly they had some fundamental pattern that they believe was at the source or creation, that they believed that there was a fundamental energy in the background, like an energy of the vacuum, we could say, in the modern physics community. And so I thought, wow, maybe there's a lot to learn from ancient civilization Maybe they tried to give us something really important
and left a hint for us.
Exactly. From their exploration, from their understanding. And that if we could get all these understandings of all these ancient civilizations from all around the world in one big pot and try to like pull out all the things that are common and that between their understanding, maybe we would get a picture of this fundamental pattern of creation.
Yeah, they might be onto something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if we applied it to advanced physics, maybe it would tell us something profound about creation. So
that's a leap right there, though.
Oh, absolutely.
That's because you had an interest in high energy physics, mm-hmm. and an interest in ancient civilizations. Mm-hmm. So the connection is you. You're the connection point right there.
Well, you know, it was a big leap, and it was a leap of faith. But more I studied it, more I realized that there was something to it, because it was just coming out every way I was looking at it. The patterns, the natural patterns that I was observing, the patterns I was discovering in ancient traditions and in building practices and all sorts of behaviors of ancient civilization and advanced physics were starting to all come together in a beautiful dance, a symphony of the music of the sphere, the foundation of creation.
Well, it seemed like that there was a knowledge of the universe at some point in our past that was lost. And so that is one way of connecting to that and finding out what did they know back then?
Exactly. Dave, you know, they wasn't just the fact that I believe they had maybe found something about the universe then. There is evidence in the world, all around the world, of very large anomalies, things that you wouldn't expect an ancient civilization not very technologically advanced to do.
But that's an assumption that we don't really have a basis for that assumption.
Well, it was more than assumptions.
What I mean is, we assume that they weren't technologically advanced.
Right.
But what I mean is they could definitely have been, had technologies that we don't understand.
Absolutely.
So that's a weird bias to try and throw on them. Like, oh, we're smarter than they were.
Right.
I don't see how that's
well, you know, certainly when I was doing calculations on some of the monuments that we found all around the world, or extremely large stones that were in walls and so
like,
on.
Like multi-ton.
Oh, yeah.
Rocks.
1,000-ton rocks.
Yeah, how do you move that?
Exactly. That were moved hundreds of miles in desert and so on. Things that we cannot reproduce today with the most advanced technology we have. And it's like, how was that done 5,000 years ago? How was that done, you know, with ropes and logs
and pulleys and levers?
Pulleys, many of these civilizations didn't even have the wheel. Mm. So, and they didn't have pulleys, you know? And so,
there goes that explanation.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, and in some of the case, there was no trees around, for instance, in the middle of the desert. Mm. You know, they didn't have logs. I mean, there's all sorts of issues. And if there was only a few anomalies, one or two here, then you could say, well, maybe. But more I researched it, more I found anomalies, and they weren't just small anomalies. They were significant.
Right. So I assume you're referring to the pyramids with some of that discussion in Egypt and Giza. Now, I've heard various estimates of when they were constructed.
Right.
Do you have any feel for that? I mean, is there any... Well, anything definitive on that now? I mean,
No, there isn't. And it's really actually sad that in our classrooms all around the world, children are taught that they were specifically built, you know,
at Cheops.
Cheops and so on. And that, you know, at certain dates, and that they were definitely built with like people pulling on, you know, hemp ropes and logs and all this stuff. When you actually examine the facts, There's actually no support for those theories, or actually very poor support for those theories. Right. And they're not thought as theories to the kids. They're thought as facts.
Right.
And that's really, you know, atrocious, because, they're theories at best. And they're not very well supported by the facts.
Well, I think it's kind of scary to stand in front of a room of kids and admit that you don't know something. You say, well, this is our best idea, but we're not really sure.
Right.
Because that diminishes your authority as the teacher.
Right. I think, however, that if teachers would do that, and if the educational system was based on this discovery and support for the children's creativity, I think you could totally... I think the kids would respect you so much more.
Yeah, even more, actually.
Yeah, if you stood there and said, you know what, we actually don't really know, but we have this theory, and this is what it's like, and this is the problems in this theory that don't actually work. You guys might be able to find a better idea of how this was done.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, we have a phone call here. Why don't we go to the calls and see what they have to say.
Okay.
Aloha, caller. You're not on the air. You got another one, Dave?
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm late joining your discussion, gentlemen.
No, you're right here right now. Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much. The question I have is, what's the gentleman's name who is speaking, the gentleman from Iran?
Nassim Harriman.
Excellent. Well, I think a great deal of his ancient forebears and all their knowledge... the Persians. And so the question I have specifically is, I've been reading a book called The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot.
Yes.
And he references the work of a physicist by the name of David Bohm, if I pronounce it correctly.
Very good, yes.
Former protege of Einstein. And basically the book is suggesting that, you know, the nature of reality is basically, we just don't know everything. They're implying that basically there is a consciousness. I don't know if you're familiar with brain chemistry, if I should make the reference to neurons firing together and firing apart.
Yes.
So the question is, you know, if the whole thing is basically a black box and it implies some level of consciousness, i.e., why when we look at a specific item, and then, wait a second, we thought it looked like a wave, but then when we observe it, it actually is a particle. So what's up with that, right?
Right.
So the whole thing is, see, I was a philosophy major, and in philosophy, someone has to say not. So that's a good starting point. And I think that when I was going to college back in the 60s, the professors of science basically characterized the laws of science or physics or whatever as being just convenient mantles, arbitrary mantles that we would place over the phenomena that would perhaps give a certain degree of explanation. Mm-hmm. But the way I was raised in philosophy, the tests of truth are consistency and congruence. Now, in relation to our friend Occam, who said the simplest explanation, which explains all the phenomena, is the best explanation, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, and in science, of course, we characterize these arguments as being of an elegant nature. So, it's my own personal belief, it may not be true or not, that the Egyptians, I mean, the word Cairo from the ancient dialect, whatever language that came from, basically is translated as gateway to the stars. So I believe the Egyptians basically built these pyramids, by using their mind energy.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it was necessary to use a whole lot of physical tools. I believe that all these civilizations were more at one with, you could call it God, you could call it the universe, you can call it whatever. But I mean, I just think we should have a very humble attitude and realize that we just don't know everything, and that the consciousness of the universe, you know, is just far exceeds, you know, our limited ability to articulate it. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, well, I'm enjoying your discussion. I'm fascinated by this whole phenomena.
That sounds like a lot more than just 2 cents to me.
Anyway,
that's like a buck and a half at least.
Yeah.
All right. Aloha.
Glad you guys are back on the air. I mean, I love all the local issues, and I am concerned about the tremendous injustice, but I mean, I'm glad we get a break from some of the local issues, some a larger perspective.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Aloha.
Did you want to comment on any of the points that he raised?
I think it was really good that, you know, Bohm did some remarkable work early on holographic theory, and, you know, it was very much poo-pooed by the mainstream physics community at the time and until actually fairly recently, when approximately 10 years ago, but more commonly known as the holographic principle, eventually became more accepted and is now mainstream, that is that the entropy of a black hole or the energy of a black hole in terms of K or in terms of thermodynamics can be calculated using holography, which is basically the concept that you can tile the surface of the black hole with little, you could think of it as little pixels, of very, very small pixels, much smaller than the atom, like billions of times smaller than the atom. And by counting the pixels and their energy level, you end up with the global energy or the common energy of the whole black hole.
All right, now, Mike, I have two questions. One is, why would that be? And backing up even further than that is, could you explain the holographic principle? Maybe kind of backstep a little bit and say, well, what is the holographic principle? What does that mean?
Well, the idea is that you can okay. So to start with the holographic plate, the holographic concept or the holographic experiments show that if you take an apple in the space and you shoot a laser at it so that the laser reflects onto a photographic plate and you interfere the light that's going to that plate with another laser so that you get like a scrambling or interference pattern on the surface of the plate, when you bounce a laser on that plate afterwards, an apple will appear in the space, in the 3D space, and that's called a hologram.
Okay, so an actual three-dimensional apparition will appear.
Yeah, apparition will appear.
And why, so, why is that?
Well...
Is that a complicated question? It's a simple question to ask.
Right.
Is it easy to answer?
Not really.
Okay.
Actually,
okay.
It's not actually fully defined what why that is.
Okay.
That interference patterns of photons on a photographic plate would produce such an effect.
Yeah, because that's not clear to me.
Right. Well, you know, you can think of it as information being encoded through the interference on the surface of the plate. A little bit like you could think of it as if you threw a bunch of rocks on a pond, you would get rings on the surface of the pond, right? And they would interfere with each other. And if you looked at the interference of the rings on the surface, you could backtrack to figure out where the rocks fell in the pond.
Hmm.
So it's a little bit like that, where you've got an interference pattern that has the shape of the apple on the plate. So when you shoot light at it, it produces an apple in the 3D space because the photons are getting that information off the plate.
But one thing that I have a fuzzy understanding of the holographic principle is that every little tiny part of the whole has information about the rest of the whole in it.
That's the amazing part.
And there's some kind of connection between every little scrap and the entirety.
Yeah, that's where I was going. The remarkable thing about the holographic principle or the holographic experiments is that if you take the plate and you cut it in half and you shoot the laser, you still get the apple.
Not half an apple.
Mm. But then if you cut it in a quarter, you still get the apple. If you cut it in eight, you still get the apple, except that every time the resolution of the apple gets fuzzier and fuzzier.
Oh, more and more
fuzzier.
Dim.
That's right.
Huh.
And so,
So there's less information information.
You're losing information.
But the information is still of an entirety.
Of the entirety of the apple.
Very interesting.
And so early on, Bohm started to think, well, maybe our universe is one of those holograms. Maybe everything we see in our universe, everything we call, you know, matter, planets, stars, galaxy, and all this, maybe it's all a holographic projection off the surface of the universe that we live in. The two-dimensional surface boundary of our universe encodes all the information that we see inside it. And he proposed that and started to write physics on it and try to find solutions to explain it in terms of, you know, atoms and subatomic particles.
And what years are this? What decades are this occurring in?
This is at the end of Einstein's life.
So the 1950s and 60s?
That's right.
Okay.
And so it is early on, and it's very much outside the box, and it's, you know, it really wasn't given much serious consideration at the time.
But then at some point, somebody got a bunch of lasers and an apple and shot them all together and like, holy moly, check this out. Well, when did that happen? When did the first physical...
No, that was prior to Bohm coming up with the idea that this experiment may have consequences to the way we think of physics. And eventually... you know, the idea continued to be brought forward into more advanced physics, and you know, but by most of the time, edge physicists and erratic physicists and all this that were trying to think about as well the consciousness. Maybe consciousness is involved in this holographic grid. Maybe what we see as the universe is actually a holographic projection in our own brain, and so on. So there was a lot of exploration from edge physicists about that. And then recently, like I said, with the work of Mr. Sutskin and others, there was, you know, and Mr. DeHoof and so on, there was an application to the holographic principle that came forth in the way we try to measure the energy of black holes.
Hmm.
And when they calculated, it turned out to be correct. And so that propelled the idea into the mainstream, and now is an accepted principle of black hole theory, which is called the holographic principle.
Well, we have a piece of the universe out there right now who's wanting to enter into the conversation.
Yeah, a bit of information. But but it may imply that, you know, the universe is kind of like a hologram. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Star Trek, the holodeck room where they just create whatever reality they want.
Exactly.
And so that could be our reality for that matter.
Yeah, in a little bit different way. More complex than the holographic plate. But interesting, it's interesting that the caller mentioned this because the paper I'm just finishing uses extensively the holographic principle to make those mathematical proof I'm making right now.
Well, let's get right back to that after we take this call from another caller. Go ahead, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, this is the same individual.
Okay, if you could make it quick.
A follow-up comment and question.
Sure.
It seems like, you know, given the analogy, and I believe correctly so, of the confluence of throwing like a rock into a pond, and therefore the different circles interface with each other, and therefore the one question I have is, because consciousness, and I by consciousness I mean read awareness by who or whom or whatever, and given the fact that, you know, this strange phenomenon that, you know, given the second law of thermonuclear dynamics and, you know, the fact that when we observe something, it actually changes perhaps the reality of what we're observing, and therefore, you know, obviously we don't know everything, and that's why I find it so exciting, this kind of open-ended kind of like wonder and awe of just trying to bring all these things together, as of course Dr. Einstein did,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the time of his death, trying to bring the astrophysics and the quanta physics together, that of the stars and that of the subatomic particles.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find interesting, I've been into like health for the last few years, and so I was researching, well, do I have the very best health water filter system. So I became aware that there's a Japanese researcher who, what he has done is, you know, he has put like the word like love under a glass of water, and under the same source of water, he puts the word hate or any given word, and the total nature and energy of the water overnight changes just by seemingly writing these English words or Japanese words and placing them on a piece of paper under the water.
Right. You're talking about Mr. Emoto's research.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, let's let him comment on that. We'll take it off the
air. Thank you
so much. Okay, Loa.
Yeah, I mean, all this is really interesting. And, you know, the idea that, well, you know, there's a few things there. And certainly some of the concepts that are being vehicled now, and you know, I assure you that 10 years or even, you know, 15 to 10 years ago, you couldn't even talk about that in a physics conference. You know, the idea that consciousness was involved was not even acceptable.
Who did they think were presenting the papers?
Well, you know, exactly. But that wasn't part of the equations as far as they're concerned. When you said the big C word in a physics conference, you'd get kicked out. And, you know, now it's becoming more and more acceptable and actually is the subject of research of some of the best physicists in the world, is how is consciousness relating to the material world and how are we affecting it? Now, the problem I see there, and this is very personal to my research, is that we're using a model of quantum theory that's really incomplete. And this idea that was the result.
Because why is it incomplete? What are we missing? What are the big chunks missing?
Well, there's huge chunks missing. We don't know the source of mass. We don't know the source of electromagnetism. We don't know the source of spin. You know, I mean, there's many fundamental pieces missing, and there is lots of paradox in our theory. And when I see paradox, I don't think the universe has paradox in it. I think there's paradox in our theory because we're missing something.
Sure, makes sense.
Yeah, and so the whole idea that was promoted and the result of the Copenhagen interpretation that when you observe an event, this is from the double slit experiment.
This is old school, right?
Oh, very much. It's actually at the heart of quantum theory and the standard model. The idea that the particle can be a wave or a particle depending on if it's observed or not, and that the result of an event is the collapse of a waveform after observation. I actually fundamentally disagree with this interpretation of the double slit experiment. Hmm. And the reason why I disagreed with it is because there's a much, much simpler explanation for what happened in the double slit experiment. And that is that the assumption that when you shoot a particle at a slit, it's in free space is an error, meaning that the particle is moving in a field. The vacuum structure has energy and it's a field. Now imagine that you have a boat moving on the ocean. You don't just have a boat, which would be the particle. You have waves that are generated by that boat on the bow wave. And those waves could go through the second slit and interfere with the boat on the other side of the slit. So all of us, like through simple fluid dynamics, I could explain the double slit experiment. I never actually did the experiment with fluids because I didn't have the means to do it. But luckily, French people a few years ago and now people in the U.S. have reproduced this experiment using silicone fluids and silicone beads and got all the same result you get from the double slit experiment just with fluids. And why would an observer change the result? Well, because if you put something in the fluid, it makes waves of its own and it interacts with the waves of the particles and then you get a different result. So in that doesn't mean that the observer doesn't have an influence on the result. It just means that everything is interacting With everything else.
Sure.
And influencing everything else, because we're all bathing in this field that connects all things. And that's the source of the theory.
So, okay, let's take another phone call then. Caller, you're on the air. Hello.
Aloha, caller. Are you with us?
Hello, that's you.
Okay, well, I guess.
Caller,
there you are.
There we go.
There you go. Can you ask him if he's familiar with Dr. Dennis Gabor?
Dennis Gabor.
Do you want to ask him?
He won the Nobel Prize for holographics.
That's right.
Well, I worked in the same lab as he did.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Well, at that time, I was on a proposal team. I was trying to be a draftsman.
Okay.
Okay. And I remember the guys were talking, and he did this experiment, and he had an ashtray, a crystal kind of glass ashtray.
Uh-huh.
And he had it on a granite block, and he shined this laser on it, and within 10 seconds or so, the ashtray just disappeared. And he turned around to everybody and said, two identical objects cannot exist in the same space.
Uh-huh.
That was it, you know.
Wow, that's impressive.
I thought it was. I still remember it. You know, I'm 65 years old. But,
right.
You know.
Then what happened?
But I was. You know, I just remember. You know, the guys were all talking about it. You know.
Right.
Because on the proposal team, we had to print everything in house because
okay.
It was all top secret. We were working on the color the scanners that brought the pictures back from the moon.
Right. So his statement was that. Was that he must have changed the energy level of the ashtray so that it could not exist in the same space as as another ashtray somewhere else.
Right, right.
Okay.
Where
yeah.
it went to, I haven't the faintest idea.
Right, right.
Did it come back?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, that's really interesting, and actually it supports, in some case, what I was saying is that there is a field that connects all things in which, you know, everything is in coordination with everything else. And you kind of get that sense even from the standard model where, you know, as you just mentioned, there is the Pauli exclusion principle in which, you know, two electrons cannot be in the exact same energy state, so that if you actually take an object in your hand right now and you heat it up, you're changing the energy level of the states of those electrons in that object. So like you have maybe billions of electrons in there and you're changing all their state because they cannot all be in the same state. But if you expand that thought further, you realize, wait, that means that as I'm changing the state of these electrons right here, mm-hmm. all the other electrons in the universe must not be in the same state as these ones. So all the electrons in the universe are modifying their energy level as well so that everything stays in the Pauli exclusion principle. So then you realize there must be some connecting field. There must be information transfer across distances.
Right. You heard of the circle of life, right?
Yes.
Right. You know, all over the, you know, different parts of, you know, from the Incas to the Iran to China, wherever, is always the same three circles.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, with a complex pattern in them.
Right.
You know, supposedly can produce energy.
Correct.
Right.
Yes. And it's tetrahedral in nature.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you think about the pyramids and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
my personal belief is that it was just done with, you know, spiritual intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, you're the second caller that mentions that.
Right. Like in Scientology, they have a thing called the clear, okay?
Yeah.
And one of the requirements for a clear is that they must lift 1 kilo at sea level with intention.
Wow.
Okay.
That's amazing.
That's a clear.
Okay.
All right. But I'm just saying, you know, they had been doing something like that. And like there was that one guy with the coral castle.
Right.
Right? That right. would move huge pieces of coral.
All by himself
all
after
by
work.
Himself.
Right.
You know?
Right. I think that one doesn't exclude the other. I think that the power of attention, the power of our consciousness, coupled with very advanced technology, could do remarkable things. I don't think that they're necessarily exclusive from each other, that the two can be absolutely harmonious and coupled with each other.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the Star Wars with Yoda, you know.
Yes.
All right, guys. I'll let you go.
Thank you. Okay. That was a great comment.
Right. Let's see. It's almost 5 o'clock here now, and I need to say that you're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. We've got another hour left, and we're talking with Nassim Haramein, and we'll be taking some calls here as we go. But one thing I wanted to mention that as part of your physics accomplishments, I guess, you solved the unified field theory. You tied together the micro world to the macro world, all with one set of equations. Einstein spent 30 years trying to do that, and he was not able to.
Right.
How were you able to do that, and what was the difference then?
Let's just say that I solved a unification theory.
Right, right. Okay, sorry.
Because there's lots of contenders out there. But I would just... If you were to boil it down to a few statements, it would have to be that every point in space, as I was saying a minute ago, are in relationship to every other point in space through this fundamental field of energy that we call space, which is not empty at all, which is full of energy, and we know that from quantum theory, and we've been able to measure it in laboratories and so on. And that because of this relationship, because you can divide to infinity, I early on started to think maybe atoms are mini black holes. Maybe atoms act like little singularities. And I started to find more and more evidence that that was true. And then when I start to write the physics for it, all sorts of fundamental constants were coming out that were correct. And in the paper, but there was some lacunes in my theory. There was some spots that I needed to expand on. I had a discrepancy of almost 39 orders of magnitude in the mass and so on. And this paper I'm finishing right now, using the holographic principle, solves all of these issues, and it comes out beautifully, super simple. A 15-year-old with a little bit of algebra can totally follow all these equations, as you know, since you've been...
Right, since I've been able to figure them out after...
Since you're 15, right?
Right, it's sometimes. Now how has this information been accepted by the physics community then? I mean, have you gotten much feedback from it?
It has been very difficult. My first three papers were not so controversial because I was addressing more subtle issues, for instance, spin being added to Einstein field equation and so on. But then I published a paper called the Schwarzschild proton paper where I literally wrote the equation showing the proton or the nuclei of an atom is a black hole. And that got a lot of, produced a lot of controversy. I got a lot of tomatoes thrown at me.
Literally or figuratively?
Figuratively, but...
So not actually.
Not actually.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, no, because I like tomatoes anyway. But I thought that, in general, I was surprised in some ways how difficult it was for people to... imagine this.
Well, you're rattling the cage.
Absolutely.
That's what you're, and that makes, that you're addressing the foundation.
Right.
And pardon me, but I'm trying to stand on that, and you're making it difficult for me to keep my balance right now.
Well, that's the thing, is that, I was basically bringing Einstein into quantum theory, which is thought to be a big no-no, that, Einstein field equation is for the big stuff, and quantum theory is for the small stuff, and you don't bring classical mechanics into atomic structures.
Yeah, but don't they call it a universe for a reason?
Right. For me, it was clear that there must be a solution that accommodates both.
All those big things are made up of small things.
Exactly.
And if the small things are following certain rules, then the big things should... One might expect...
That there should be a relationship.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And when I did that, it rattled a lot of cages, because most physicists today... Students are very much interested in studying quantum theory, but very little actually study Einstein field equations. I mean, cosmologists do, but not necessarily in very great details. And, you know, so it was thought to be, I mean, completely inappropriate to do, to bring Einstein into quantum theory and to describe the atom as a mini black hole. Yet the atom has all these incredible behaviors, very high energy. You can collide a few atoms together and get an atomic bomb to occur, you know. There's a lot of experiments in quantum theory that show that, you know, particles seems to be connected at faster than the speed of light at a distance. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance and so on. So, many of these behaviors match the behaviors of black holes.
Okay, we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Aloha, and welcome to Out of the Box.
Hello?
Aloha. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've been following a lot of your work, Crossing the Event Horizon, Nassim, and a lot of the things you've done. And
wonderful.
It personally makes me feel good that you seem to involve a unconditional love consciousness, you know, that, you know, although you're, you know, strong in the physics part, that seems to be involved. So if you could comment on that. And then the other question I have is, to your knowledge, how many ET civilizations are you aware of in our Milky Way galaxy? And I can take my answers off the air.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
What was that term he used? What kind of civilizations?
ET civilization.
ET. Oh, ET, okay.
Well, that's a great comment and question. I think unconditional love, first of all, it's really hard to achieve. I'm still working on that one. When physicists comes at me with words of insults, you know, my tendency is not to be unconditionally loving at that point. So I'm still working on it, but I think that, it's critical. It's critical that we realize, and really it came from all this research I've done and this fundamental feeling I had from very early on that we're all connected, we're all in the same boat, we're all linked through this field, and that you know, we're all reflections of each other, and that we should collaborate and support each other, and you know, even when we disagree with each other, that we can find higher resolutions than of resolving conflicts than starting to shoot at each other. And so,
yeah, and that's not working so good.
No, it doesn't do the trick.
It doesn't seem to add up to a positive future.
That's
right. Or even a positive present.
Right, because according to what I found, whatever you put in the field comes back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, which in many ancient civilizations was thought as the karmic wheel.
Sure, or blowback, as they call it today.
Yes. And I really feel like when you realize this connection between all things, you just get, you know, you get this sense of awe, this sense of amazement, of gratitude for everything. And, you know, even gratitude for the people that may be difficult for you to accept, you know, like in one way, some of the people that are my worst,
critics, or detractors.
Yeah, distractors.
Distractors. I like that. That's a good one.
They are really on one way forcing me to clean up, you know, the edges of my theory to make sure that I account for everything. They're forcing the field to evolve
into a greater sense of clarity.
That's right. And so if I can take it that way, which I don't always, then it has a capacity to propel me.
Mm-hmm.
And so really staying open heart is so critical. I think it has a very, very important role in our capacity to transcend this moment in our history right now.
Beautifully said. Do you want to address this second question then?
Sure.
How many ET civilizations are you aware of?
This is a touching subject. Until fairly recently, I would not discuss these things. I knew better because I already got enough flack. But recently I felt that it was now time. I had from very early on in my childhood direct contact with what people may think of as extraterrestrial civilization. And
well, that'll help open up your worldview a little bit.
It sure did.
Yeah.
And thinking that there's more out there than what meets the eye. And, you know, throughout my life, I had many contacts. And so I could say fairly comfortably that I was in a meeting. You could call it a meeting or a conference of the sort, where I met, I would say, over different 100 different species of extraterrestrial beings. And, you know, the diversity is extremely large. And, you know, it's remarkable that with all the evidence that we have on this planet everywhere, ancient evidence and modern evidence of having being visited by other beings from our universe, which is not so hard to imagine.
Well, it's not hard to imagine, and we're certainly imagining it now. There's lots of TV shows where that's the whole basic premise of the show is, you know, these are aliens, or this happened 15,000 years ago. And I think that's actually very healthy. It helps open up the mind for thinking about things. Imagining is really only the first step.
So where
that's
was
not
this,
what that's not what you're talking
where
about.
Where
was
this meeting?
Imagining.
No, I had a direct
where was this meeting?
This meeting.
Is it on the planet?
No, this specific meeting was in the ship.
Okay.
Yeah. And
how did you get there?
Well, with a smaller ship.
A smaller ship.
Yeah. And
and was this a ship of your own creation, or was this someone who came and said, hey, let's go get this guy and bring him to the conference?
No, they literally came and got me and put me in the ship and then brought me to that other ship and brought me to that conference.
That seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it was pretty. It was extremely straightforward, and actually I was... You know, I was cooking at the time, and I was actually worried that my meal was burning while I was having this conversation with those guys.
Interesting. We have a call here. Let's go to the phone. Aloha.
Aloha.
You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to clarify a comment the gentleman made regarding, did he suggest that the nucleus of the atom was in fact a black hole?
Yeah, a mini black hole.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I've been reading a lot of things on the net suggesting that the dark matter is in fact an electrical phenomena.
Oh yes.
And the thing I find interesting is I personally believe that, you know, mankind was given a few jolts in the past by these visiting intelligences. People just didn't go from being farmers in Egypt to creating the pyramids, right?
Right.
We couldn't even make them today with all our technology. So the thing is, you know, when I, you know, I many zillion years ago, I read that book, The Chariot of the Gods.
Wait, a zillion years ago?
Well,
how old are you, caller?
I won't mention that. The thing is, because out of deference to our Persian learned friend, whose civilization, ancient civilization, I have tremendous respect for. And but anyway, the question I have is, you know, I mean, does the gentleman think that perhaps, you know, the faces on Mars, where the geometry is exactly of the same geometry as we have, a type of geometry we have here on Earth. Does he think that was created by a quote unquote alien intelligence?
Okay, we'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm actually quite skeptical of the face on Mars mount.
It seems like when they looked at it with better resolution, it just disappeared into a mountain.
Right. Well, you know, there's issues there too, because we didn't get the resolution that we expected to get from that new probe. So I don't know what they were doing there. But I'm more actually puzzled about the pyramidal structures that are found all around that thing. I think that has actually much more merit. There is tetrahedral and five-sided pyramids around there that are hard to explain from natural phenomenons. They seem to be placed in an orderly manner that you'd expect from like an ancient city and so on. So I think there's some merits there. Like I said, I have, you know, had direct contact with extraterrestrial civilizations. From straight logic, it makes absolute sense that there would be thousands, millions, billions of different civilization, even in just one galaxy.
Sure. Well, we've already found over 800 planets around other stars.
Right. Well,
at the very beginning of a search for that kind of stuff.
I mean, it must mean that that they can travel faster than the speed of light.
Right.
Because if we just look around our, you know, neighborhood here, there's nothing that close in. You know,
that's right.
We're at 150 stars within a couple of light years.
That's right. We would expect that if they can come here, that they can transcend they can transcend the speed of light. Right. Now, is there evidence in physics that that's possible? Actually, Einstein field equations make that very clear, that it is possible. Dr. Wheeler eventually found solutions for wormholes. It's clear that you can, according to our current theories, not mine, just the standard theories, that you can fold space and time if you had the right energy levels and create tunnels between very far distances so you could, you know, basically tunnel from one to the other. And then just recently we're starting to realize these tunnels may actually be linked to black holes, so that the black holes are like the hubs of all the tunnels that connects all things in the universe. And if atoms are black holes, then that means atoms can be the hubs too.
Right. Okay, caller, you're on the air. Hello.
Well, good luck with me.
Finally,
all I can say.
Okay, we'll take you up on that.
I wanted to backtrack a little bit. Some caller here a couple of calls ago was asking a question regarding how many extraterrestrial civilizations are you aware of on the planet. And I was just watching a TED lecture last night, and the lecturer was relating evidence that's been discovered over the last 20 years on the North American continent. It all goes back to the mound builders that had left their constructs all over North America, and how there are literally hundreds of these constructions, and that essentially every one of them is a lunar calendar, that there are alignments and openings left in every one of these small devices, that when the equinox rolls around at sunrise, sunrise lines up on it, and there you go. So
right.
It's like, now, curiously enough, the researcher was also relating the story that from colonial times until the late 1800s, as archaeology began to develop and digs were happening on the North American continent, that there had been as many as 200 different sets of skeletal remains that had been unearthed and shipped to the Smithsonian, and that the skeletal remains were all between 7 and 11 feet tall, and that all of them had two rows of teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you consider that the ancient books on the planet, between the Vedas and the Old Testament and the Greek pantheon and the Enuma Elish, they all seem to be derived from the Enuma Elish, which is a much older story. And what does it say? That the Sumerian gods arrived here 500,000 years ago, and 200,000 years into it, they made us as labor from a creature of the earth, which more than likely might be Australopithecus. He's the man of Earth that is in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. I mean, you find, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you find this all around the world. You know, almost every ancient civilization around the world has a creation story that involves beings that came from the stars, sun gods, they call them all sorts of different ways, but that came from, not from the earth. Even in the Bible, you know, it says that the sons of God came to the earth, so they weren't from the earth.
Curiously enough, there's that verse in Genesis that, depending on your translation, it says the watchers in the heavens, or it says the sons of God
right.
in the heavens.
That's right.
Looked down upon the daughters of men and saw they were beautiful and mated with them, and their offspring were giants.
That's right. And so there's so much evidence all around the world from these ancient civilizations that leads further. I mean, this might be shocking for some people, that, as you mentioned, that the Homo sapien might be an engineered race from an advanced civilization.
I think the modern genetic research is bearing that out more and more, because as they look at Neanderthal DNA, they've decided Neanderthal isn't even a relative
That's
of
right.
mankind.
Exactly. There's more and more evidence that the Neanderthal and the Homo sapien are not necessarily directly related, and that, you know, and it's in this evolution in the natural world is very, very strange. You know, all of a sudden you have a smaller being with a brain almost twice the size, larger eye and so on, but much more frail, that basically overtakes everybody else and so on. So yeah, there's a lot of discrepancy that points to the possibility.
Now, interestingly enough, the way the Vedas end, that's the Indus Valley's holy books, they end with this description of the war amongst the gods that brings the gods' time here on Earth to an end.
Uh-huh.
And the Vedas state that war extends from the surface of the Earth all the way to the moon. So when you look at the Clementine moon missions from 1994, and there's 1,800,000 color pictures from that orbital device, They seem to plainly display ruins of antiquity all over the moon, much of it that looks to be blown to smithereens.
That's interesting. I've heard that too.
There's a filmmaker out there named Jose Escamilla, and he has done extensive work on about only 800 of those pictures from the Clementine mission, and the stuff that he has demonstrated through, you know, they do simple enhancements. They tinker with the contrast, which a lot, you know,
right.
NASA's that's the abbreviation for, you know, never a straight answer from those guys. when you look at the astronaut testimony from John Glenn on, it's just been a steady flow of, we got a bogey at 10 o'clock. You know, there's always something flying around with them up there that doesn't belong.
Right. Hey, I got another call. You got any closing comments?
Thanks for the show.
I
really appreciate you guys and your forum.
All right. Well, thank you, caller.
Thank you. Aloha, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Go ahead, caller. Welcome to Out of the Box with our guest today, Nassim Haramein.
Nassim, you're a very sincere, beautiful person. Obviously, you're very bright. But just on a comical note, are you getting close to the cure to the common cold? Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I appreciate.
So, are you getting close to the cure of the common cold?
Oh, man, I'm working on that one. I'd love not to have to get a cold every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell you what, while we have a little break in the action here, I want to kind of switch to another topic. For the listener who might see this tape later, this is November 29th, 2020. 2012.
Yeah, 2012. Dude.
Coming in just a few weeks is the end of the Mayan calendar and, the beginning of a new era, or some have theorized. What do you think?
Yeah, what's your
is
take?
Going
what's your
on?
Take on the end
what
of the
What is
world?
Happening now? You know, what is going to happen?
Well, as I've been saying all these years, is that I do have a period of time in my cosmology when I started to try to run the numbers on the cosmology based on my theory, that in this period of time there would be cosmological changes in our solar system. And the reason why is that I extrapolated the structure of galaxies based on the theory I've written that involves a double torus and there's some complexity there. But I started to try to calculate where our solar system is relative to the field interaction of this double torus that englobe our galaxy. And so you can imagine if you have a torus which is like a donut on top and a donut on the bottom, you would get jets, and we found those jets and so on. And then, you would get an equatorial thickness, right? And you would find that most matter would tend to want to gather there. And that's what we see when we see a galaxy.
Sure.
And then I start to extrapolate, okay, our solar system is spinning like a spiral going up from the upper torus down to the bottom torus and back up. And I try to pinpoint when it would cross the line of forces, the high magnetic line of forces of the boundary of one of the toruses. And I came up with something along 2012 region, but it's a long region, meaning it's like at least a 10 to 15 year period.
It's an epoch.
So, I really don't think that it has to do with a specific date, although there may be specific dates where specific events occur. But I think that it's a period that we're going through. And when you look at the graphs, or for instance, the increase in seismic activity, the increase in hurricane activity, the increase in temperature and heat on the sun and all this stuff, you see that in the last, 10 years, there's been an increase that you see on the graph where the baseline goes up towards acetate. And, it really is clear that there's an increase in activity in all these various activities on the Earth. But as well, recently, we've had these probes that we launched some 30 years ago.
Voyager?
The Voyager probes that were able to actually get out of the heliosphere.
Yeah, they're coming up against it. They're bumping up against it.
That's right. And they're still, sending data back. And we're for the first time able to look a little bit at our environment. And sure enough, they discovered that we are entering in a region of denser magnetic fields and with a higher level of particles and so on, and that it's creating a heating up effect on the surface of the heliosphere. That it's
like a bow shock.
Yeah, exactly. And so, that for me is very confirming that we are in a region of space in our galaxy which will change the dynamics of our sun, the dynamics of the level of temperatures in our solar system and so on. And we're seeing evidence of that all over our solar system. So what do I think about it? I think it's not one date. I think we're in that time. We are in that shift right now. And I think it's going to continue to shift, and we better be prepared for it.
Words to the wise. We get another caller here?
Yes.
Yep. Aloha, caller, you're on the air.
Thank you. I remember once back in the 60s, I met Isaac Asimov.
Oh.
And I asked him, I said, where do you get all these visions of the future from? Where's it come to you? I can't even remember a record, And he says, everybody thinks it's the future. I'm just remembering the past. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's interesting.
If you want to know about space travel, check out Operation Pegasus.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard of that one?
Yeah, I have heard about it, but I'm not familiar.
Yeah, that's the you know, how you call it, teleportation.
Okay.
You know, going through, you know, holes from one planet to another.
Is this something that NASA's working on? Because I heard that there's somebody...
They were working on this in the 40s.
I heard there's somebody at NASA right now who's actually working on a warp drive. A friend of mine was telling me about that just recently, actually.
Yeah, way back in, you know, the 40s and the 50s, they were working on that.
Uh-huh.
Right. Anyway, check that out. It's called Operation Pegasus.
Okay.
All right. Great, thanks.
I even heard Obama used it once.
Oh, really?
Maybe that's how he won Florida.
How he went to Mars?
That's what I heard. Yeah. Okay, I'll see you later.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. This is so exciting. This is a wonderful show. Thank you so much. I'm Thank kind you. Of curious. Are you allowed to divulge what the conference was about?
Oh, we're back in outer space now.
Oh, okay.
I have a follow-up question, too, about your dinner, if it burned or not. I'll wait.
Well, that was a cool thing. It was like my dinner didn't burn because it would burn with my van, you know. but the conference was about very deep and serious concerns that the galactic community had about activities that were occurring on Earth. And I was not previewed to what those activities were. They would not disclose that, but they were clear that it was horrendous, that it was having a serious impact on the rest of the galactic community, and that they had to take decisions about what they were going to do about it. And
why did they bring you on?
It seemed like, and I assume that they brought other people, but it seemed like they wanted to get a sense of the opinion of people that were on the surface about how humanity was doing, and if it was something that was, let's say, worth continuing.
Yeah, I was going to say worth keeping.
Yes. And so, go ahead.
I was going to say, and possibly because you've got such a fresh outlook on this physics, perhaps they gave you a little something. I'm not saying that they gave you something, but
did you put in a good word for us?
I sure did.
Okay.
I gave it my best shot.
No, and the fact that you are bringing something that could really help.
Right. Well, you know, I think because of my history of communication with them from early on, I think in some ways they knew they could do this with me without me completely freaking out or passing out or anything
like that.
And but certainly I think it was a turning point for humanity at the time. And
what year was this?
Well, it was in the it was 1990, let's see.
Trying to think where your van was parked then, you know?
Right, exactly. I think it was 96, right? 1996.
Wow. And I'm glad that you're willing to talk about it. Thank you.
Right. It's brand new for me. I feel a little, you know, strange talking about it. It's been very close to my heart for all this time, but I feel like we're at this point in our evolution where we need to open the door, pull out all the skeletons and like, you know, be full disclosure. And it's time for people to expand their horizon and realize we're just not alone in this universe, and there's a lot of interacting parties, and we can become part of a larger community.
Yeah,
that's pretty exciting. Now, there's one other little thing that I want to bring up, and it's so off the topic, but it's Giamofri Kauai is showing the movie Dirt tonight.
Sure. Okay, go. You want to make an announcement of that? Go right ahead. Yeah. This, in addition to doing interviews, this is also a community radio station. So please, by all means, make use of this resource.
Dirt the Movie is showing tonight at Nakekioka Aina, the Children of the Land, which is next to Papayas. It's a free event, and it starts at 7.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay. You're so welcome. And just because I'm on the topic, I just want to throw it out there because a lot of people haven't heard yet, but we're going to have in January, Vandana Shiva is going to be here, and it'll be a free event also.
Well, that'll be great. I'm really looking forward to that. We'll probably cover that better once we get closer to that time. That's January 17th?
17th, yeah. We're asking people to save the date because so many people don't know who she is. And, I mean, anybody who does know who she is sort of doing cartwheels.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, like, why is she coming to Kauai? That's amazing.
Because we need it. Because we asked for her to come, and she's
well,
coming.
It's still
amazing.
It's gonna be at the Kauai Convention Center at the Memorial Convention.
Peace and Freedom Hall, okay.
Yeah, we're at
So we can fit 1,100 people, so that means we need to get a lot of people to know that she's coming.
Let's
it's a chance in a lifetime that she's coming.
Right. Well, we're at ground zero for GMOs, so that's probably partially why she's there. Okay, thanks very much for calling.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, a question regarding the gentleman's perspective on if they should find the Bogue principle, right?
Higgs boson?
Yeah, excuse my mispronunciation, you know, at CERN or wherever. Would that in any way shed any light, you know, on the holographic understanding of in which we exist?
That's a good question.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll take it off the air.
That's a really good question.
Now, they are saying that they have found it, but they're checking their numbers or whatever, but they're leaning toward announcing that, it seems like.
Right. They did, in the last few months, there was a big announcement that they had found the Higgs boson, the Higgs particle, and, you know, they've been looking for a long time. And, I mean, in general, they built this accelerator mainly to try to find the Higgs particle, which costs some $13 billion.
Sure, money well spent. You know, since we have so much money these days to do whatever.
I think that while it's interesting, it is a big part of trying to confirm that the standard model of quantum theory is correct, because at the base of quantum theory, we have a big hole of the baryons as a result of the theory. So at the end of the day, they still have to do all sorts of hand-waving to get the other 99% the mass.
Oh. That sounds a lot like our political problems with the missing 99% in the way decisions get made.
Exactly. But recently, they've announced that they found it, but when you look at the data, you find that they found it at the very edge of where the theory would say the energy levels would be. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the data, it's very unconvincing that they actually found that particle. There's other contenders that could be what they found, and so on. So, you know, I think the jury's not drawn on this, and I think that we but whatever the case may be, I think that we're getting closer and closer to discovering, and certainly the paper I'm going to publish now is going to hopefully bring that forward in a much more coherent way, that the vacuum energy, the energy at the source of creation, is the source of the gravitational field, the source of the electromagnetic field, the source of mass, and so on, that like everything emerged from this fundamental field and returned to this field. And you know, the kahunas in Hawaii knew about it. They called it mana. In many ancient civilizations, they had different names for it, you know, chi and all sorts of different appellation for it. But most of the ancient civilization knew about this fundamental field from which creation occurs. And I think that at the end of the day, this is going to be the most simple and clear explanation, and it's going to really propel us.
All right. So at the end of the day, you usually go to bed and go to sleep, and then you wake up and it's the next day. What kind of opportunities are there out there for discoveries in the material world that can begin to confirm some of the theories that you're putting forth? Because it's always nice if you have a theory that makes a prediction, and then you go out and discover that.
Right.
And then you go, hey, that's supporting evidence that my theory is maybe true.
Absolutely.
What kind of physical discoveries or possibilities are there for physical discoveries that would begin to confirm some of the things that you're saying?
Oh, many. One of them would be a more accurate description or measurement of the radius of the proton would confirm my theory.
And if it turns out to be what you're predicting it should be,
that's
then,
right.
Okay.
There is as well more and more evidence, experimental evidence that confirm the existence of this fundamental field. There was earlier on experiments that are called the Casimir effect that showed that two plates could be pushed together if they were close enough.
If they were smooth enough so they could be close enough.
That's right. And if they're close enough, then you're eliminating some of the energy of the vacuum between the plates. And since there's more on the outside than in the inside, then the plates get pushed together. And that was theorized in 1947, but nobody could get plates smooth enough to do that until the 1990s, and then these experiments were reproduced over and over again. There was still a lot of controversy about it, but then recently, in the last 2 years, there's been a dynamic Casimir effect that was produced by electronic devices where the plates are replaced by fields. And in this case, they're able to extract, listen to this, they're able to extract photons directly out of the vacuum. That is, we're extracting light
out of nothing.
Out of what we think of as nothing.
That would suggest that's not what it is.
That's right. Well, it certainly would suggest that matter and creation can emerge directly out of the vacuum.
Interesting.
In the right conditions.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah.
Okay, we got a couple of calls here. Let's go to the phones. Caller, you're on
Hello?
The air. It's you.
Okay. When I was younger, I traveled considerably number of times out of my body, and I could hover in one place or I could go at any speed and out anywhere where my imagination could take me.
That's always nice.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I felt was always protected and, unconditional love again, and but I also became aware that our solar system and our galaxy and our local universe is all moving into different parts of the cosmos and in a pattern that's like a DNA spiral. And I was wondering if Nassim, if you could comment on that. It always intrigued me that we're always charting new territory, really. I mean, literally in the cosmos, and we're not really repeating anything.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that I included in my layman's videos, is an appropriate visualization of what our solar system looks like, because we teach children every day in schools that our solar system looks like a sun in the middle with planets orbiting around it in a circle, as if the planets were coming back on the same path over and over every year. And the fact is that is absolutely not the case. That view of our solar system is as if our solar system was isolated from the rest of the universe. And it's in some ways equivalent to thinking the world was flat before we discovered it was round. And because our solar system is moving, our sun is moving at thousands of miles per minute through the galaxy, and the planets are following our sun, creating this huge DNA type spiral through space.
Like a corkscrew, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so every millisecond is different than this millisecond prior to it, because we're crossing new coordinates in space-time. And that is, I think has profound meaning. And I think that visualization is critical and should be taught to children, because it truly is the way the mechanics of our universe function. You could extrapolate that to the galaxy. The galaxy is not you know, stationary. It is moving through space inside the cluster of galaxies that we belong in. And that cluster is in a larger cluster we call a supercluster, and so on. And so everything is in constant evolution. Everything is in constant movement. And every moment is different from the prior moment because everything is constantly readjusting. And I think that's where that feedback relationship between the vacuum and the material world is occurring, where everything is constantly informing everything else of the changes that have happened so that there is a continuous and coordinated evolution of our whole universe or the multiverse. And that's why things like our biology on our planet can exist, is because they can cohere in a coordinated manner and create highly complex system in very short amount of time, which in, if you did the statistics in mathematics for even a blade of grass with all the microbial life and the DNA and all the stuff that's in it to come to cohere in a random universe, it's almost impossible. It wouldn't happen.
Well, I think they said God does not play dice with the universe.
That's right. That was definitely Einstein's opinion, is that there must be some fundamental principle that makes self-organization happen, and that systems of high level of complexity must occur because of a structure at the base of it that produces that feedback. And
the pattern generator.
That's right. And so this is very, very critical to our understanding of the universe, that it is not random, that it is highly organized, highly coherent, and that the whole thing is spiraling through space as it learns about itself.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I would go out to a certain point and look back at the Earth, and then I'd go out to another point and look back at the solar system. I'd go out to another point and look back at the galaxy. And then I'd go out to another point and just, you know, I'd have fun with it. And then I'd start getting concerned that I wouldn't come back. And the way I achieved that was by realizing that vacuum was informed, you know, that it was, the vacuum is actually unconditional love. I keep saying that word, but I don't know how else to articulate it.
Right, because it's in contact with everything else, and so it's actually in love with everything. It loves everything, and it's learning about everything, and it's putting everything together in such an amazing coordination and complexity. I mean, people don't realize how amazing the fact that they're just breathing right now.
I like breathing.
It's an amazing thing. Like, you know, there's enough DNA in one human being. If I unraveled it, all the DNA in your cells right now, I could wrap that strand of DNA around the world 5 million times. I could go from Jupiter to the sun and back to Jupiter and back to the sun and so on 6 times. With the DNA inside your body that's making everything happen.
Wow. Yeah, that's just awesome. You know, it
really is. Yeah, that's unconditional love right there.
Okay, we have another call we're going to move to.
Thank you.
Aloha, and welcome to Out of the Box.
Hello, is that me?
Yes. This is you.
Speaking of unconditional love, I just like to say I love this guy. I'd really like to get very high with him someday. Does he live here on the island, or is he visiting? I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the show.
No, he does live on the island here now. Also, hey, I wanted to make this announcement. They're offering a delegate program. Nassim is offering a 3-day program where he talks about all of this information here in January 25th, 26th, 27th. on Kauai. So it's a great opportunity to get some feedback and, you know, have a chance to talk to Nassim about these topics.
Yeah.
And get really high with him?
That's between you and him.
I don't know about that.
We're all adults here.
And then I heard him just mention quickly something about a video.
Yeah, there's videos available of many of it. You can go to YouTube and you can find 100 hours of videos. Also on his website, theresonanceproject.org, there's many of his videos there as well.
Yeah, I would suggest the more recent videos from, for instance, the one produced by Guyam called Black Holes. W-H-O-L-E. And you can get those at our website, theresonanceproject.org and theresonanceproject.org. And as well, you can see the schedule of the various programs that occurs around the world. I'm looking forward as well to do an evening talk here for the Ohana here in Kauai very soon and present my latest findings. So,
we'll
keep your eye out for that.
Yeah, and we'll announce that on the show here because I'm volunteering at Nassim's lab and helping with some of the research. So I'll be up on that and make that announcement.
Well, I have a question for you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
As you're doing all this
Thank
work,
you.
As you're doing all this work several times now in the course of the conversation, you've pointed out that you feel it's important to get this information out to people in a layman's fashion so that more people can understand. Why is that? Why does that matter to you?
Because I think that it brings people to a deeper understanding of themselves, the universe around them, and it's critical at this time. People are so discouraged, you know, and desperate to get a feeling of belonging, that we're not just some little piece of scrap, that your life really doesn't matter, that the universe really doesn't care, you know, as well that you don't have to necessarily revert to some, religious belief where you have some God that's overlooking everything, that actually there is mechanisms in the universe that makes it possible for you to be here and that there is a relationship between you and the universe. You are evidence of that relationship. And so when people discover that, it has a profound impact on their lives. I mean, one thing that keeps me going, other than my scientific curiosity and my own exploration, is all the letters I get. Like, I got hundreds of letters of people, you know, thanking me for, you know, changing their lives in their understanding of themselves and their understanding of their world and the natural world around them. And they, it has a profound impact when you start to realize that you are connected to everything. You know, before you kill an animal, before you cut a tree down, before you pollute with large industry and so on, you might think twice.
Or maybe even more than just twice.
Right. And if you realize that you are connected to all these things, they're not separate from you, and that you're having an impact on yourself by having these actions. And so I think it's really critical at this time that people understand that.
And why do you say at this time?
Well, because we're reaching a very critical moment in our history where our technology and our evolution is demanding that we reach higher level of understanding so that we harmonize with our environment. We're destroying our environment at a very rapid rate. It's like the earth is like a little nest that allowed us to grow to a certain level, like a bird in a nest in a tree. But at one point, the bird has got to learn to fly because there's going to be a hurricane. There's going to be a little wind. There's going to be a little, storm, and the nest is just going to fall out the tree because the bird's too big. There's too many other birds in the nest. And so we've reached that point. We need to understand the way things work better so that we can develop technologies that are harmonic.
Rather than harmful.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And that are fundamentally based on the structure of creation instead of the destructive part of creation.
Sure, like, or the explosive part.
Yeah, exactly, in the radiation part and so on. And so there is ways to get there, but in order to get there, there's got to be a discovery, a self-discovery that's present in our own being, in our own existence first. That's the first step. And that's why it's very much linked to spirituality and consciousness. It's not separated from that. The evolution of technology is very much a reflection of the level of consciousness of a civilization.
Hmm. Okay, we do have two more calls here. I'm going to try and get them. If caller, you're on the air. If you could be quick,
sure,
we'll try to
no
get
problemo.
A couple.
Sure, no problemo. Is today's show being recorded and archived so we can listen to it again?
Yes, it is. I'm recording it right now. We're going to have it on the website here probably within a few days.
What do I look for?
Just go to the KKCR.org archive section, and it'll be listed on there.
Yeah, it'll be one of the out-of-the-box shows.
So out of the box by date?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly.
It'll
probably say Nassim Harman on there as well.
What?
And we'll make an effort to label the show so you can see what it is.
Name.
And what will be the name?
Nassim Haramein.
Spell that, please.
N-A-S.
M?
N, like,
N.
Yeah, N-A-S-S-I-M.
Yes.
Haramein. H-A-R-A-M-E-I-N.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right.
Hello. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Aloha. Welcome to Out of the Box. I think we've got time for this one last call.
Hi, I'm one of Hasim's alien friends calling from a stellar planet called Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Oh, good.
Good job, Hasim.
Oh, thank you.
You know, there's a movie clip that was from Waterworld where in this boat where the Exxon's LDs, you know, there's this old man, he's working in the hole, you know, cleaning up oil, and there's a fireball coming right at him and it's going to kill him. And he goes, and he's basically a slave, right? He goes, oh, thank God. It's a cute little clip, but you know, when I put my hands together, you know, it's mirroring energy. It stabilizes atomic energy and it holds my form together. It's two opposing entities that mirror each other to my spinal column, and that's the center of the universe for me. But thank you very much for the show, guys. Aloha.
All right, thanks for calling.
Aloha.
Okay, caller, this is the last call. If you can be very quick, we can
keep
it. I will
try to be. I really appreciate your guest and particularly what he just said within the last few minutes of how having a spiritual experience can unite us all and is what we're looking for. And I just want to ask him if he's ever looked into a Bodhi leaf.
No, I haven't.
Well, if you're here on island, I have a Bodhi tree. And no disrespect to my Buddhist friends, I have many, but Buddha reputedly received his enlightenment under a Bodhi tree. And if you look into a Bodhi leaf, you will understand why he had that spiritual transformation. He was a man of means, and he was looking for answers, and he found it under the Bodhi tree. And I believe it was because he really studied the leaf. The leaf shape is exactly the same on every Bodhi tree. But the veins of the leaf are entirely different. And it just goes along with your theory of the snowflake.
Uh-huh.
It's the same shape, but every snowflake is different.
That's
and
right.
it impressed me when I saw a Bodhi leaf because it meant to me that even though we have unique inner characteristics on the veins and so on,
yes,
we are all the same.
That's
and we
right.
are all linked together.
Very
always,
good.
All the time.
That's
and
right.
I think the best word to describe that is love. It's just love. How could it be anything else?
Right.
But to totally respect every living being on this planet and in the universe. And I really appreciate your being so articulate about this. And thank you so much for coming on our great radio station.
Thank you.
Aloha.
All right, thanks
Aloha.
For the call.
I think just a quick comment on that. You know, if we live in an infinite universe of universes, that means that it's like a fractal structure. And in a fractal structure, every point is the center.
So, so what he was the previous caller was talking about is the center of his universe.
That's right. And so you're the center of the universe, but you got to remember that so is everybody
so
else.
So is everybody else.
Yeah, otherwise you'll get in trouble. But when you, and so although we're all different, I mean, although we're all part of the same universe, we're all different because we all observe the universe from our own very specific perspective.
For which is not the same.
That's right.
Not
like, if we look at a cup together, you're seeing one side of the cup, I'm seeing the other side of the cup. If we're looking at a wheel spinning, you'll say it's going one way, I'll say it's going the other way. So that gives us the individuality in a oneness system, like we're all connected, but each one. And so that's why every single perspective is critical.
That's what I think.
That's right.
That's what I think.
Okay, well, we're out of time now. Thank you very much, Nassim, for coming in and
you
talking
know
to
we're
our
We're not out of
here.
Time, Dave, because time is infinite.
That's right. We're out of time for this show here. But, yeah, thank you very much. I hope the listeners...
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I hope the listeners got something out of that. I know some of them did. But in terms of contact information, you want to give out, you know, the websites?
Yeah, again, the Resonance Project Foundation, the Resonance Project Foundation is at the resonanceproject.org website, and there you can find all sorts of material, my technical papers as well, and then schedules of the events. As well, you know, you can become a member of the Resonance Project Foundation and get newsletters every month and so on.
Well, okay. Nassim, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us. It's certainly been a very pleasurable couple of hours here that we've been able to spend.
Yeah, it went by very quickly. We were only able to scratch the surface on some of these topics. They were very interesting then. Okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks, and I think we're going to have Graham Nash in the studio here to talk some politics there. No music, but...
We might have a little music. You might want to make a musical point.
Maybe so, but we're here to talk politics with
and of course,
them,
anyway. And get your calls in as well. So we look forward to that, and we've got Moe's coming up in right away with his acoustic luau. Thanks so much for listening and tuning in, everyone. We'll be back. And aloha. Ahui ho.